everyone, and welcome back to the Faculty of Horror, podcasting from the horrid halls of academia. I'm Alex West with
Andrea Subisati.
And we are powering up for another episode. This is an episode I have long wanted to do. I don't quite know why. I just think it's a really interesting topic, and I wanted to learn a bit more about it for myself. So today we're going to talk about video game horror movies.
Yeah, it's going to be kind of an interesting multimedia topic because they are two very different beasts in many ways, as I'm sure we're going to get into. Personally, I think I'd call myself a gamer. I'd call myself a casual gamer. I came into it at about the 8-bit Nintendo era, and my sister would play Mario Brothers, and I would sit and I would watch her, and I would watch her for hours, and it would almost be like we were playing it together, even though we weren't. Like, if she felt like playing, she'd be like, where's Andrea to come and sit and watch me? And then when she moved out, I was like, well, I can't watch Lisa play anymore. So I started playing, and I got amazing at it, way better than she ever was. She'd come back for the holidays and see me play and be like, holy shit. And I stuck with it. The irony is that when it comes to these particular games, they're a bit of a blind spot because they were PlayStation titles that dabbled in Nintendo a little bit later down the line, but I became an Xbox girl when that stuff came out, so I didn't actually play these as a kid.
I played a bit as well. I'm definitely not a gamer. I played a bit as a kid, and similar to Andrea, I have a much older brother, and when he was living with us, when he was, I guess, kind of in his late 20s and I was still like a kid, he would play and I was just fascinated by these games and I just wanted to do whatever Giles did. So he'd occasionally let me have a go at them. So that was a pretty big deal. So the big ones for me were Legend of Zelda, A Link to the Past, and Donkey Kong. That kind of weird, almost 3D one. Mm-hmm. I remember playing that a lot. And then the Mario ones. And I was really interested in Mortal Kombat because of the movie and that song. Holy shit, that song.
Choose your destiny. Flawless victory. Choose your destiny. Flawless victory.
And then I just kind of got away from them. Like, that was around the time that games moved out of the Super NES system. And I didn't want to spend any money I had or any money my parents had on another set because I think I'd played them with other friends and I just didn't get the controls. There were, like, too many controls for me. And I tend to be one of those people, like, if I'm not good at something pretty quickly or I don't adapt to it, I tend to back away from it. And I think also when you move from side-scroller video games to a lot of video games, where you get into a room and then you have to run to a door and it goes to black and then it powers up again in another room and you have to run to another door. I was like, come on. And again, that's a whole other way of playing and pacing of story and of video games. And it just wasn't for me. So that's kind of where they lost me. But I have seen them around the apartments of ex-boyfriends. It's been very exciting.
I've actually had a bit of a renaissance with video games lately. I have always had a system in my home, an Xbox system, and right now my partner has the new Xbox One, which I probably wouldn't have shelled out for. He got it as soon as it came out, and it was ridiculously expensive, and he plays everything as soon as it comes out, and I knew that I loved my games, and I knew what it felt like to be totally immersed in a really good shooter, and I was like, oh, when the new Halo comes out, I am taking a week off work and powering through it. When the new Gears of War comes out, I'm going to take a week off work and power through it, and I just never did that. So in preparation for this episode, I jumped back in. I checked out Gears of War 4 and I played it with my boyfriend and I had this crazy sense come over me, this crazy feeling of really being one with your hands. And it's something that I think the gamers listening to this episode can totally relate to. But when you first start playing a game, you're kind of learning the controls. You're kind of figuring stuff out. You're hitting jump when you want to be changing weapons and stuff like that. But once you get the hang of it and your fingers are moving independently, they're just moving at the same frame rate as your brain. And it's a feeling that I can only liken to playing an instrument when you have that kind of compatibility with your hands and your brain. And it's a really wonderful feeling. And when you're playing a game that has a terrific story, and the stories of games nowadays are amazing compared to what they were back in the day. Now we actually have writing departments and cinematic director people who steer the ship. So yeah, I'm glad that I got back into that world a little bit for our talk today.
There's also another element with gaming that I think can be a barrier to a lot of people. And the fact that the games evolve so quickly, the systems evolve so quickly. I mean, like, the history of video games only kind of really, really started in popular culture in the 1970s. Before that, it was like computer boards that evolved into Pong, that evolved into Atari, that evolved into Nintendo, then Super NES, then Sega, then N64, and everything else that came after that. So if you're kind of a newbie or a novice, it can feel very intimidating to start. Like, where do you start? And especially as a woman or anyone who's not necessarily fully ingrained in the culture, it's a weird thing to go and ask a question, especially online, and hope that you don't get a lot of hate for it. And I think the culture around gaming is very intimidating. I had heard bits and pieces of it from friends like Andrea, and it can be a lot, even watching some of the playthroughs of some of these games where guys talk over it while they play. Like, some of the language they use, like, I'm not a prude, but it was very upsetting in a lot of ways.
Oh, yeah. I think you're actually being quite kind.
I just don't want the gamers to yell at me.
They will. We're bound to tick off a couple, but I think gaming culture is a really nasty place. And even some of my favorite games like Halo and Gears of War that I am very competent at, I have no interest in playing online. It just saps all the joy out of it because of the hostility. Yuck. No.
One of the YouTube series I really like is one done by Anita Sarkeesian, and she does a series called Feminist Frequency, and she's tackled things like movies and television shows, various tropes that span multi-platforms. And to me, I really like her. I think she gives really clear, concise analysis. And if you listen to this podcast, I'm sure you can guess that's something that I really like and I really respect when it's well done. And I think she does a great job. And so it was very upsetting to me to see, as I was discovering her and she was starting this video games versus women tropes series that she crowdfunded for, and the hate that she got, this intense vitriolic hate. There's something that if you're a woman or a minority or you're not necessarily ingrained in this culture, and it's nerd culture, it's geek culture, it's whatever you want to call it, you see this hate and it's like, I don't want to go near this with a 10-foot pole. There's a lot of monetary barriers in terms of accessing games, in terms of accessing systems. And then there's just emotional barriers. Like, I don't want to get involved in this.
Geek culture is in a really strange place right now because it is so popular. Video games and superhero movies, Marvel movies are so, so popular. So I do feel like there is kind of an aging generation who were like, I used to be persecuted and bullied for liking this shit. And now that it's cool, it's mine and you can't have it. Like, don't appropriate it away from me. And that's something, on the one hand, I can kind of understand. On the other hand, it's really unfortunate. But we're not here to talk about video games proper. We're here to talk about movies based on video games, which again occupies its own world. It's not quite in the gaming world. It's not quite in the cinema world, but they exist just the same, for better or for worse.
And as Andrew was just saying, video games are adapting to more cinematic qualities, just like I think films are trying to adapt to more video game-like qualities. It's like the snake eating itself. They're just kind of constantly seeing what works in the other, pulling from it and trying to integrate it. So there are some really successful video game adaptations that are fun and silly and crazy, and there are some that are really terrible. And I think today we chose two that for me really resonated with me just as a film fan and as someone who's interested in the way stories are told and the way narratives are told. And they tell similar stories in a way, but very differently. And I have a real soft spot for both of these.
Me too. They're not perfect films by any stretch, but they are a lot better than most movies based on video games. I feel like we can't talk about movies based on video games without at least mentioning a figure by the name of Uwe Boll. Now, Uwe Boll is a German filmmaker who made numerous movies based on video games that are all terrible. He made Alone in the Dark, which is cited by many as the worst movie of all time.
But starring one of my first crushes ever, Christian Slater.
So if that's a redeeming factor, then there's that. Now, his movies were largely panned, and Bol is kind of hilarious because he challenges his critics. He gets really pissed off when people shit all over his movies, which is funny because he's not exactly an artistic guy. It's common knowledge that Bol KG, his production company, took advantage of legal loopholes such that his movies were ways of moving cash around tax-free. In Germany, taxes had to be paid on returns, so it was actually better if the movies were bad. So German investors made free money for all those piece of shit movies. And hilariously, he would challenge his critics to boxing matches, and there was this crazy publicity stunt where he actually fought a reviewer for Rue Morgue magazine. He got in the ring with Chris Alexander, and they boxed. I was watching footage of it just today, and Juve just landed a right that drew blood from Chris's mouth, and he threw in the towel.
Chris is out, folks. That's it. A very good round and a half, I have to say. He did a good job, and look at that, a nice hug. That's what we like to see. He put up a fight, but Uwe took it home.
Since then, he has pulled a couple more stunts where, if provoked, he will react. And he made a YouTube video in 2015 telling all of his critics to go fuck themselves. So he was in the news, and he is kind of a hilarious figure. Anyway, as we've already said, in the early days of gaming, stories weren't all that important. Technology was new, technology was emergent, video game systems were really trying to outdo one another in terms of graphics and gameplay and speed and things like that. So story kind of took a back seat to those. And it was the same with movies based on games, as they focus on emulating the game's feel. They focus on satisfying fans of the game by conjuring up those same elements. Novels and comic books are story-driven, but not so with games, at least back in this era. Also, the player is the star of the game when you are playing a video game, even if you're playing as another character, and the exploration and discovery has to come from you. So that's another hurdle that movies based on video games face.
So there's a real challenge when we talk about video games that are turned into films, because how much do you have to be beholden to a video game to, on one hand, really satisfy your fans of the video game, and on the other hand, satisfy fans who maybe aren't familiar with the video game, but are kind of fans of what you're selling? So I think Andrea and I, and why I was so excited to talk about this for this episode, we kind of occupy both those spaces. Like, Andrea is a gamer who has experience with some of these games, and I'm not a gamer, but I like what a lot of these games are selling. I like the idea of survival horror. I like the idea of getting to play through a game that I can be scared and freaked out by, but it has a really rich mythology, but I don't personally have the patience to like figure it out and sit down and do it. So for me, movies like these that we're about to talk about today are kind of the best of both worlds. So to get us started, we're going to be talking about Paul W.S. Anderson's 2002 film, Resident Evil.
Thank you!
Deep underground. In a top secret research lab, security has been breached. A deadly virus, capable of contaminating the entire world, been released by Umbrella Corporation.
Oh my god.
We have to get out of this building! What was that? It's the break!
It's okay, we're here to help.
Now, an elite team has been sent in to stop it.
5 hours ago, Red Queen went homicidal.
Who's the Red Queen?
State-of-the-art artificial intelligence.
The corporation's keeping a few secrets down here. Something you're not supposed to see.
But they have only 3 hours left before it begins infecting and mutating the whole human race.
Everyone stay calm.
What's that?
It bit me, man. She took a chunk clean right out of me.
You have to get out.
Don't listen to anything she says. She's a holographic representation of the Red Queen.
She may be our only way out of here.
God. How is she still standing?
She isn't standing now.
No one is immune. Resident Evil.
You're all going to die down here.
In an underground genetics lab known as the Hive, an intruder breaks in and breaks a vial of the T-virus before they escape. The Hive security system known as the Red Queen overrides all the controls and kills the workers within the Hive. Meanwhile, Alice wakes up in an empty manor unable to remember anything. She and a police officer named Matt, who is also on the premises, are apprehended by an armed sanitation team who lead Alice, Matt, and Spence, who they find along the way, back into the depths of the Hive to figure out what happened to all the employees. Members of the team are killed by the Red Queen's self-defense mechanisms. The remaining members disable the Red Queen, which opens all the doors and passageways in the Hive. What the remaining survivors realize too late is that the Red Queen was protecting them by containing all those infected by the T-virus, who are now zombies. As the dwindling team fights their way out of the Hive, Alice begins to regain her memories and her abilities, and she remembers that she's actually an operative for the Umbrella Corporation who run the Hive. Weary of what the Umbrella Corporation was up to, Alice sold secrets to Matt's sister, who also worked in the Hive, so they could expose Umbrella Corporation. Spence is revealed to be Alice's partner and husband, who double-crosses the team and broke the vial at the beginning of the film. But the Red Queen takes care of Spence by unleashing the Licker on him, a huge zombie hybrid monster. Matt and Alice make it back to the manor, but Matt's wound from the Licker can't be treated by the antidote, and Umbrella scientists arrive on the scene and put him in the Nemesis program. Alice awakes in Raccoon City, the city above the Hive, after a zombie outbreak has spread and destroyed the city. She prepares to do battle. So this film was released in 2002, meaning I would have been about 17 when I saw it. And I remember wanting to see this film so badly. Like, I was primed for this film. And I've got two words for that, and that's Mila Jovovich. I love Mila Jovovich. If you're kind of around our age in your early to mid-30s, The Fifth Element was such a huge film. Like, it's such a fun, weird cult film, and she's amazing in it. And she's obviously beautiful, so she was a model at the same time. So as, you know, a girl growing up through her teens, like, her L'Oreal ads were omnipresent in magazines and commercials. She was this kind of pinnacle of style and beauty for me. So the fact that she was in not only another genre film, but in a kind of horror action survival film, like, holy shit, that was so right up my alley. And I still remember, like, one of my favorite scenes from this film is just her slow-mo kicking that dog in the face, where she kicks off the two walls and just kicks the dog right in the face. Like, when you see that in a trailer, I was like, sign me up. I will be right there. Like, I would watch Mila Jovovich meal prep in slow-mo. I would watch her fold laundry in slow-mo. Like, that's how much I actively like her.
Oh, for sure. I'm a huge fan as well. Starting with The Fifth Element, which, as you mentioned, she was amazing in. And then even with the Resident Evil franchise, I think she was a really large part of why the franchise continued as long as it did. She came back to the role again and again and again. And normally this is the kind of thing where, okay, the first couple of movies, you know, you made your money and you did your thing. And normally the big movie star doesn't come back again and again, but she had such a blast filming this. I was watching the featurettes for Resident Evil, and she learned martial arts. She obviously knew some from The Fifth Element. She did a number of her stunts, and she just had a blast. She loved it. And there's so many reasons I love her. She's also an accomplished musician, a fashion designer. She's a cannabis activist. So there's a lot to love.
And speaking of love and why she maybe enjoyed this film so much is that she met and fell in love with the director, Paul W.S. Anderson, on the set of this film and all the subsequent films. Again, he was another returning element to this franchise. They broke up briefly, I think midway through the series. So that's when he like wrote one, but he didn't direct it. Now they have two kids and their daughter, their oldest daughter, plays the Red Queen in the latest Resident Evil movie. So it's all like family and stuff like that. And also to mention that this was not Paul W.S. Anderson's first foray into video game films. He had directed the initial Mortal Kombat movie, which is incredibly silly, but oh my God, do I love it.
I love it. It's so fun. It's so fun.
It's so much more fun than it has any right to be.
Yeah, it's exactly what it wants to be. And Paul W.S. Anderson is famous for saying, I'm not here to please critics. I'm here to please fans. And I think that is evident, especially in these two films.
Yeah, and of course, also to just give him another horror shout out, he also directed Event Horizon.
Amazing.
Amazing.
That was a little bit before this one, I think. So yeah, that was maybe cutting
between
his chops in the sci-fi horror genre.
Yeah. But all that going to say, that was my entrance into this film. It was basically Mila Jovovich doing cool shit with zombies. I'm on board. I will pay any admission price. But this film also has a kind of weird storied production history as well. Basically, Resident Evil was a Capcom game, and it was initially released in 1996, and it was super popular. People loved it. They were into it. It was a real forerunner of a lot of the stuff that would follow it, and of course led to its own successful video game franchise. It kind of helped popularize the zombie figure yet again in popular culture. And so when people started to talk about, oh, well, this could kind of easily turn into a movie. We should make a movie out of this. Who would be the best person to make a movie out of zombie survival horror game stuff? George Romero worked for years on developing it and working on it, and the people at Screen Gems who eventually made Resident Evil hated his treatment. So he was kind of unceremoniously dismissed from it. There is a lot of kind of chatter online. You can hear a couple different versions of how that all went down, but basically no one was happy and he was forced to leave the project, and Paul W.S. Anderson, who is coming off of successes with, as we mentioned, Mortal Kombat, Event Horizon, and was a generally well-liked person and very young and adept and in tune with a youth culture, wrote this treatment and developed it, and they went for it.
That's really interesting. I actually didn't know any of that, but it stands to reason. I was thinking about George Romero when I was thinking about this film because Resident Evil, along with 28 Days Later, is often associated with the new zombie movement, the zombie nouveau revival movement, where the living dead were faster, more ravenous, and they were reanimated due to some clear biological reason. And modern day fast movies are often criticized for being unsympathetic to the zombies. They're just a mindless horde to pump bullets into. And George Romero was a big proponent of this kind of concern. He voiced this concern with regard to video games and The Walking Dead specifically. So I have a feeling that might have been something that went wrong. However, with that said, I feel like Resident Evil is very sympathetic to the zombies that we encounter because this sympathy is established early in the opening shots of a bunch of poor schmucks just going to their day job. You know, they work this deep underground and they've got these fake window treatments to make it look like they're outside.
Makes it easier to work underground, thinking there's a view.
Putting in another day at the office, completely unaware of the work that they're doing or the peril that the company puts them in. Plus, we learn later that there's an antidote, but still, these safeguards are in place to just wipe out all the employees rather than treat them.
Mm-hmm. I also think it's interesting because I hadn't seen the movie in a couple years, and then going back to it, that opening sequence, you don't necessarily need it in the film.
Mm-hmm.
But in my opinion, it's probably the best directed, best edited sequence of the film. I have a lot of love for this film, but as just a straight on film critic and viewer, to me, that opening, I don't know, 5-7 minutes of them all kind of mulling around the hive and trying to get out and then it all going fucking wrong is eerie and scary and disorienting, but there's such a firm guiding hand in terms of narrative and structure to it that it's very impressive. It almost works incredibly well as a short film. So after young 17-year-old Alex, I think probably convinced my father to take me to see it because I probably couldn't afford it really on my own yet, I was like, fuck, I want to find like an N64 and a version of Resident Evil, and I want to play this. I want to be Mila Jovovich. I did. Somehow I scammed someone into letting me play it, or I rented it or something. And I was quite shocked and appalled to find that Alice was not an actual character in the game. You're just nodding at me. But yeah. I was in absolute shock. And then I had this game for like a week and I was like, I don't know what to do with you. You're not Mila Jovovich. I can't help you. It struck me a bit as I was thinking about it for this episode, a bit like what they did to Kirsty in Hellraiser, how she was an older kind of female friend of the family's and they made her the daughter and imposing this final girl narrative on the character. Mm-hmm. And I feel like they almost did a similar thing with Alice. So obviously I don't think any film was ever truly hurt by having a beautiful lead fronting the film. So Mila Jovovich definitely fits that bill. She's got a nice international appeal. And to help her sign on, you want to give the character a compelling narrative arc. And it works so well because Alice begins not knowing anything. So she's just like you, the audience. She's going through this thing. And as a narrative device, it works so well because characters constantly have to explain things to her and it makes sense.
Listen to me. I want to know who you people are and I want to know what's going on here. Now.
And at the same time, as she begins to regain her memories and as she begins to regain her abilities as she's forced to, it's almost like the player themselves, you as a viewer, are getting more adept at like the controls of a video game. You're kind of responding to it. And so she's acting more like an action hero rather than a person who's being dragged along by the narrative.
That's right. I thought her character was very well written. I was always with her. She doesn't know anything. We don't know anything, as you say. But the things that she learns, she's never obnoxious about. She's never a stupid blinking. What does this mean? What do I do now? You know, she's quiet. She observes. The camera takes pains to notice what she notices. So when things happen that have significance to her, we'll get a cue that's like, oh, what does this mean for her? Oh, this corporation's really evil and she works for them. How does she feel about that? And then as things come to light and it turns out that she's actually infiltrating the corporation and looking to turn on them, but there's that little flirtation with her and her husband for a sec. You remember that?
Yeah, because he's a fox.
Yeah, he's hot.
Here.
No, it was
fine. Please, come on. It's cold in here.
But when she takes a leadership role, she's very competent and she has great empathy throughout the film. All the characters do. It's a really amicable team where at first they're very adversarial, but as the story goes on and they're all in it together, you're just on board and you want everyone to survive.
I also really appreciate that while they put her in kind of a skimpy dress, she's wearing flat boots.
Yeah.
And when Spence, Hottie McHotHot, gives her his leather jacket, it's like an oversized men's jacket. It's not like he's wearing it. He hands it to her and it magically shrinks down to like form fit her. Like she looks relatively comfortable. And there's a few scenes of her nude in the film to varying degrees. But again, they didn't feel too male gazy to me. It just felt like she was having a shower and she fell down. You would be naked. You were in a hospital being experimented on. You would be naked. Another important thing to mention, because Alice is a character who's really superimposed on the film, who's not in the video game or wasn't in the early stages. Obviously, the Stars troupe, as they are known, they were a big proponent of the initial games and they helped evolve the narratives of Raccoon City and Umbrella Corporation and The Hive. But what's interesting to me about the addition of Alice and certain other elements to the film is how it begins to deeply reference Alice in Wonderland. So the other most obvious reference to that is the character of the Red Queen. So that's yet another character in Alice in Wonderland. And just like anything else, Alice has fallen down a hole and she falls and falls and falls, and she has to kind of face the monsters that come her way until she discovers something about herself. And if you read any analysis of Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland, and Lord knows there's a shit ton, they all center around the fact that Alice in Wonderland is a search for identity. And it's a search for identity of a 7-year-old girl who oscillates between being very childlike and very adult. And the notion of Alice having no memory and falling down this hole and being confronted by the Red Queen in terms of a kind of power structure, it's very much like gameplay. And if anyone knows Alice in Wonderland well or remembers one of the film versions, a lot of it has to do with a chess match, which is really a match of wits. And that's what Alice and the Red Queen, as they kind of work through the hive together, sometimes working together, sometimes in opposition, they're very much trying to serve their own needs and getting the other person to help them serve their own needs. Now, another important thing to consider when we think about Alice in Wonderland as a literary piece is that a lot of people identify it as not only Alice's search for identity, but about the absurdity and chaos of adulthood and of power structures. So I can't think of anything more chaotic and absurd than the Umbrella Corporation, which is a corporation, as they say in the opening narrative.
At the beginning of the 21st century, the Umbrella Corporation had become the largest commercial entity in the United States. 9 out of every 10 homes contain its products. Its political and financial influence is felt everywhere. In public, it is the world's leading supplier of computer technology, medical products, and healthcare. Unknown even to its own employees, its massive profits are generated by military technology, genetic experimentation, and viral weaponry.
So they're producing lifestyle products, beauty products, Lord knows what else, all of the things that we would want to use day-to-day life, but they're ultimately financing and working on all these like biohazard, weaponized, military things that would ultimately serve to hurt you. So they've got this kind of duality that I think is really interesting. And again, it serves to speak to a bit of the duality that I think Lewis Carroll saw in adulthood that he was speaking to through Alice in Wonderland. So for all those lit nerds out there.
There you go.
I got you.
The Umbrella Corporation is the real villain here in many ways. They're deceiving the entire world by hiding behind these household products that are supposed to make our lives easier. They're deceiving their own employees with their true motives. And then they've got these safeguards in place such that the employees are utterly expendable in the event that something goes wrong. In fact, the first several victims of the film aren't killed by zombies or dogs or mutants at all, but by the Hive's safeguard lasers, or the Red Queen. Now, a corporation is defined as a company or a group that is authorized to act as a single entity, and it's recognized as such in the eyes of the law. A corporation can do many things that an individual can, but it's considered distinct from the people behind it, which protects its members legally. And I was doing a bit of research on this, and I found that in Canada, anyway, there was a whole bunch of legal reform with regard to corporate law in the 1990s, because in 1992, 26 coal miners died in an explosion in Nova Scotia. And they found that the supervisor in charge of the miners was aware that the mine could explode, but sent the workers down there anyway. But they weren't able to get a proper conviction, because in Canada, you need to be able to prove both the act and a murderous intention. And so this led to legal reform in the 90s, specifically Bill C-45, which expanded and elucidated the ways in which a criminal act or intention can be attributed to a corporation. And it created a legal duty for corporations to take reasonable steps to avoid bodily harm. So at least in Canada, this was a hot topic at the time this film came out of, can a corporation be held liable for the damage it does to its workers? The first company in Canada that was successfully convicted under this bill pled guilty to a worker's death, and all they had to do was pay a fine of $110,000. Nobody goes to jail, nobody is liable, and that is the price tag on a worker's life. So I was kind of ruminating about that while I was watching this film, and I think there's so much that this film does well. It is very much a horror sci-fi film. We've got the zombies to contend with. We've got the Red Queen to contend with. We've got Spence turning on them. All these things happen, and we still have a fantastic narrative arc with a really strong protagonist. It's a testament to what this film does really well.
And I think it's another example of zombie films working really well as critiques of society and how threadbare these social niceties and these social contracts we have with each other and with our bosses and our workplace, how truly, truly tenuous they are and how it can all fall apart so quickly. And I like that initially the Red Queen is set up as the antagonist of the film. She's this evil fucking thing and we have to disable her. And she killed members of that team. And in the amazing sequence in the chamber that all lights up with the lasers.
So good.
I still remember my father laughing his ass off because it works so well. Because it's like once and you get the understanding of, okay, it's going to slice you in half. Then, oh, he can make it again. Oh, no, it sliced her head in half. How is he going to get out of it this time? And he doesn't because it shifts and turns into a graph and just cuts him into bitty, bitty pieces.
It is pretty funny. It does have an element of humor in there. It's kind of fucking with you.
There's definitely that kind of like sick British humor, which again is something my father loves very much. And I think I've inherited that where it's like, it's so sick and twisted and cruel that you can't help but just kind of laugh at the sheer absurdity of it. And of course, Paul W.S. Anderson is British. So there you go.
Many of the cast members are. I was watching the featurette and there was many cast members who had British accents who didn't have them in the film.
Yeah, it was a France, Germany, British, American, Canadian co-pro.
Wow.
So it was a lot of financing to get this done. And it speaks to that because, again, the game was an international sensation. So the film should be an international sensation and it should speak to a lot of different things. And I like how there's the dichotomy in the film of when it opens, it's in this like super hyper modern, really clean aesthetic hive, which is all about weaponizing and militarizing these viruses to be used in war or God knows what else. And then it cuts back up to Alice in the mansion, and the mansion is like gothic personified. It's an actual house in the middle of nowhere in Germany, I believe. And it's this really interesting thing that in the rural outskirts of a lot of these major European cities, there's still, you know, a lot of history, and there's so much more history than I think we have in North America in terms of architecture and things like that. So I like that it's this old gothic mansion that leads into this hyper modernity, and it's kind of the perfect cover for it.
Now, the mansion is actually why Resident Evil is called Resident Evil, at least when we're talking about the original game. The literal translation from the Japanese title had it as Biohazard, but because the game takes place in a mansion, they changed it to Resident Evil. And I remember the first time I came across the game, I was at a sleepover at a girlfriend's house, and we were babysitting her little sisters. You remember when babysitting was an opportunity for a sleepover?
No, I think you got had.
Oh, totally. I'd be like,
I never did that.
I'm going to babysit for free, but it's cool because it's a sleepover and no parents are around. Woohoo.
Oh my God.
Really?
You should sue them.
Nah. It was great because we got to play Resident Evil. I was so excited because I didn't have a PlayStation, but my friend did. And I'm like, yes, we're going to play this when the kids go to bed. Kids fucking go to bed so that we can play Resident Evil. So we put it on and we play for a couple of minutes. And the very first dog comes smashing into the hallway as she's walking through. I mean, we chose to play as Jill Valentine, but
fuck yeah, you did. Or like how I always play it as Sonya.
Well,
of
course.
Mortal Kombat,
of course.
They were the best.
Yeah. And the playable characters, there were two playable characters. And of course, they had their differences. They each had their strengths and their weaknesses. Jill was able to hold more inventory items and more ammo. But if you played as Chris, you could take more hits. You didn't have as much ammo and you didn't have as much inventory. So if you wanted to be tough, you had to be the guy. But that's neither here nor there.
Because you couldn't hide stuff in your vag or cleavage.
That's right. So a dog bursts in through the windows in the mansion. My friend was so freaked out that she turned it off. And for the rest of the evening, she talked about how scared she was. And I remember trying to convince her that the only way to sublimate her fears was to confront them. And we just had to keep playing. And you can just watch. I'll play and it'll be fine. And I'll show you because I'm going to kill the dog. And just please let me play it. And we didn't.
Oh, my God. That sounds like a terrible sleepover.
Yeah, it's the worst. I had the worst childhood.
So yeah, the brief time I had to play this game, I did not excel at it. I was constantly getting like stuck in corners and I didn't understand why the doors took so long to open. And again, I think if Andrea and I had played together when we were kids, I probably would have gotten a lot more out of it, but that didn't happen. So here we are. And what I did in prep for this episode was I watched a lot of gameplays, all the gameplays I could find on YouTube. And it was a strange thing because I just assumed I could type in Resident Evil gameplay and videos would come up and I could watch them. So I started clicking through them and I found all of these videos and they were all narrated by the people playing them. And God, if you want to hear every character, every animal, every inanimate object get called a bitch, then I highly recommend just searching Resident Evil gameplay. And I tweeted something to that effect, and thankfully some of our lovely listeners and some of my lovely followers helped me out and said, no, you have to search for long-form gameplay. So thank you, guys. But there's a lot of oddities when you watch video games, and there is kind of a hypnotic quality to them. I see how people can get sucked in. I can see how some of these videos have over 7 million views and are still growing after having been online for years. But there's so much weird cutaway action in the cutscenes. There's a lot of weird gender dynamics that happen and a lot of stuff. And I feel like maybe that's why, in part, I never truly got into these games, as well as not being very good at them. Because there's a lot of, like, female characters standing around with their boobs out and, like, their butt out and just kind of making silly comments to male characters. And I'm so grateful that my introduction and my shepherding through of Resident Evil was through a character like Alice and through a lot of the other characters as they were realized on screen. Because they were really strong and interesting. And I think I mentioned this in the last episode, but I believe I've seen all Resident Evil films in theaters. That's a lot of love. And the last few are truly unwatchable. Like, truly unwatchable. I don't know what they are thinking. And I think Paul W.S. Anderson can make good films. I think he can make really entertaining, fun films. I think he's always had a good cast. I just don't know how they've gotten so off the rails. Like, I can't even qualify them as films anymore. The last Resident Evil Final Chapter, which came out earlier this year, I went to see in theaters with a friend of mine, and she just had a baby, and it was like one of her first nights out. And I was like, you want to come see this dumb movie with me? And she was like, yeah, I do. And we watched it. And we were watching it in like IMAX 3D because that's the only time that worked for her. And she was like, oh, I feel so dumb. I don't know what's going on. I was like, I have no idea what is happening in this film. And like nothing was happening, but it was so weird. We had a fun time watching it because it was pretty empty. So we were kind of laughing at it a bit quietly. And then we got up and the film ended and we were talking to each other and just like, wow, that's crazy. What happened with that? What was that? What's this? What's that? Oh my God. And we turn around and there are these two kids, probably maybe in their early 20s. And they were like making out so hardcore. Like the girl was basically on top of the guy. And I was like, someone is having a Resident Evil baby tonight. That is a thing that is going to happen.
I hope you name it Alice.
Yep. But yeah. Alice herself, the mythology that is peppered throughout the entirety of the franchise, kind of mirrors what I understand the game mythology to be, but it builds on it through this kind of final girl narrative, which I think is really interesting. Again, Mila Jovovich is still a relatively A, inexpensive, but B, internationally recognized star. So that's kind of perfect for something I would consider a B or C level franchise. Mm-hmm. If you're going to put a lot of investment into things like special effects and pulling different elements and trying to create not necessarily a cohesive narrative, but a narrative that speaks to fans and to gameplay, then she can probably carry it through. So I think the first film is really successful. I think maybe the next two films are okay. And from there, I would not be able to explain one element of them to you. But I tell you this, if there was another Resident Evil film, I would go see it.
At this point, you have to see it in the theater. You just, as a completionist.
Well, Mila would know if I didn't.
I did a little bit of YouTube research in preparation for this episode as well. And one thing I saw come up more than anything else on the topic of the Resident Evil movie is gamers just love to say how shitty it is, even though I think this first film is excellent, but they are panning it on the basis of the liberties it took from the original game material. 10 reasons why Resident Evil sucks, because the T-virus is supposed to be this and this and that, and this is supposed to be this, and the Red Queen is supposed to be that. And again, I feel like it just harkens back to what I was saying before, how gamers have an almost puritanical command of their domain, and they don't like to see it encroached upon, and they certainly don't like to see it bastardized or whatever it is they think that this film did.
Well, Andrea, I'm glad you used that word puritanical, because that is something that leads in beautifully into the next film we are going to talk about, and that is the 2006 film by Christoph Gans, Silent Hill.
Honey, sometimes when you go to sleep, you go on a little walk, and sometimes you talk about a place.
I don't remember.
That's why we're gonna go there, so you can remember.
Sharon's gone. I need your help.
I'm not okay. Please, hurry.
Fire started 30 years ago.
Dad! I don't know what's happening. Do you know what's going on here?
This place is completely cut off.
Only the dark one opens and closes the door to Silent Hill.
Hey!
Where is she? I'm trying to find my wife.
She looks exactly like Sharon.
Why? Rose, come on! Rose, hurry! It's coming!
What's happening?
Oh!
Sharon!
To find your daughter, you must face the darkness of hell.
It's okay, baby. Mommy's coming. Ah!
The film centers around Rose and Christopher and their adopted daughter, Sharon. Sharon has a bad habit of sleepwalking and calling out for Silent Hill in her fugue state, so Rose decides to take Sharon on a road trip to the ghost town of Silent Hill against Chris's wishes to uncover her daughter's connection to the place. On their way to the town, they encounter police officer Sybil Bennett, who follows the pair to Silent Hill. Rose speeds off when Sybil tries to pull her over, resulting in a car accident. When she comes to, Sharon is missing and the town is bathed in falling ash and a weird fog. Rose searches for her daughter, dodging encounters with nightmarish, deformed creatures, and learns of a girl named Alessa Gillespie who looks exactly like Sharon. Sybil re-enters the picture and tries to arrest Rose, but they soon wind up joining forces as the town gets stranger and more malevolent. Meanwhile, Chris has made his own journey to Silent Hill, where he meets Detective Tom Gucci, who is sympathetic to Chris but also advises him to keep his distance from the town and its sordid history. Eventually, Rose and Sybil learn that Alessa was apprehended by the town's fanatical cult and was burned alive, an event which also caused a giant fire that set the whole town ablaze. Alessa survived the burning but developed demonic powers as the result of her suffering, I guess. We'll just roll with that. Anyway, the cult apprehends Sybil and burns her alive before turning their gaze on Sharon, who they're holding captive. Rose teams up with Dark Alessa, who is a personification of Alessa's rage. Again, just roll with it. And when Rose confronts the cult for their bullshit, Alessa exacts her revenge on the people who lynched her. Rose and Sharon return home to Chris, but they remain in separate dimensions and can't see or interact with one another. It sounds really crazy, and it's a bit crazy, but it's still a lot of fun. It's a very effects-heavy film, and the effects stand up for the most part. And there's quite a bit of pathos to be found here. The ending is tragic, particularly for Chris, who essentially loses his entire family. And the supporting characters of Gucci and Bennett are incredibly sympathetic and altruistic.
And the only thing I would actually add to that synopsis, and again, it's a rather complicated narrative that this film weaves, is that when the cult was initially burning Alessa, the burning went wrong as the fire took over and Alessa was able to like knock it over with her kind of supernatural rage powers, which caused the fire to spill over and fall into the town's coal mine caves, which essentially caused this eternal burning within the coal mine caves, which is what causes the ash to fall in the second dimension that Rose and Sharon and Alessa and everyone else is in.
Yeah, they refer to it as the other world. So mm-hmm. not the underworld per se, but just kind of another dimension on top of that. Now, there's plot holes galore if you're just watching this film and are not that familiar with the game franchise, which I was. Every so often, an alarm goes off and a strange darkness descends and a bunch of scary shit happens, be it misshapen burnt children, a plague of bugs, or a giant terrifying motherfucker called Pyramid Head. Who is Pyramid Head? Why is this darkness intermittent? If Sharon is a personification of Alessa's goodness, why isn't Sharon 30 years old? What's up with the interdimensional shift, and why did they take that back with them back to Chris? Can they see anyone else in the world or just each other? There's a lot of questions, but watching this film, I was really happy to roll with it.
Yeah, it's also part of my new favorite subgenre of horror films, which is the surprise witch movie.
Ooh.
Which, for anyone who this doesn't speak to, would be a film that is kind of about one thing, and then holy shit, it's about some kind of witch burning or evil wrought on a town because of their subjugation of someone they believe to be a witch or an undesirable. And I've seen it a couple other times. I don't want to mention any of the other movies because it tends to be a bit of a spoiler.
I know what you're talking about.
Well, the people who know, know. But I really enjoy this. And I had seen Silent Hill maybe once or twice years ago. And again, it's kind of convoluted and it doesn't really make a lot of sense when you step back from it and think about it. But I really enjoyed it. I love the risks that they took with it. And Christoph Gans, he was mainly known before Silent Hill for directing Brotherhood of the Wolf, which was a French film. And also notable about Silent Hill, the film, was that the script was, it's certainly solely credited to Roger Avery, but Christoph Gans and some of his other producers worked on the story as well. But Roger Avery is kind of most well known for working and writing on Pulp Fiction and Reservoir Dogs. And he had a rather large tiff with Quentin Tarantino and the Weinstein brothers over at Miramax. So he was unceremoniously exiled from Hollywood in favor of Quentin Tarantino. So it was kind of nice and interesting and weird to see him reemerge with something like Silent Hill. And if you want more about Roger Avery and his own kind of journey through Hollywood, there's a really great book called Down and Dirty Pictures by Peter Biskind, which is about the rise of Miramax and Sundance film festivals in the 90s, which can really go into the politics of that time, if you are so curious.
Now, director Christoph Gans fought hard for the rights to this title. He went so far as to send the game producers a video interview of himself outlining his plans and how much the games meant to him. He hired the sound designer of the original game to consult on set, and he also reportedly brought in a 40-inch TV and a PlayStation 2 so he could show the crew how he wanted things to look. So I think a lot of this movie's foibles and plot holes can be explained by the fact that he really wanted to satisfy the fans of the games more so than a movie-going audience. It's not a happy accident that it also turned out to be a pretty solid movie with really interesting effects and a lot of pathos, as I said before, but that's what he was going for.
For me, one of the most important things about Silent Hill as a film is its use of the doubling motif, or the double motif. And this was most famously used by Alfred Hitchcock. And this is where generally it's a character or characters, or sometimes it's a scene or a narrative that parallels another one. Usually they're kind of the inverse of each other. And they serve to illuminate different aspects of what the kind of main protagonist is going through. You can see this very clearly depicted in something like Rear Window, where you have Jimmy Stewart as an invalid watching a life across the street from him and freaking out and seeing a potential murder or a crime happen. And so that's kind of has a doubling thing, but Hitchcock uses it constantly. Now, doubling in Silent Hill is so predominant. You have it between the characters of Alessa and Sharon. You have it in between the two dimensions of the Silent Hill, the one that Rose and Sharon are in, the one that Christopher is in. And then finally, you have the mother motif, which is shown between Rose and Dahlia, who is Alessa's mother. And again, both flower names. And I think often when we think of doubling in this metaphorical sense, we tend to gravitate towards the easier descriptors. So that would be something like good or evil, dark or light. And what I like so much about Silent Hill is that it complicates these notions. So obviously you have something like Alessa, who is believed to be this demonic force who's terrorizing this town, and she brings on the darkness somehow. And then Sharon, who is all good and light and just, oh, mommy, I love you and I miss you so much. What I think Silent Hill really gets at, and we touched a bit on it when we talked about Resident Evil, is that the notions of good and evil are very archaic in a lot of ways. And good and evil is much more of a grayscale than I think we're willing to admit to ourselves. And the bigger our worlds get, the more experience we have, the more we realize that things aren't always black and white, and that these characters serve to illuminate different aspects of what is good and what is evil. So Dark Alessa was caused by the fundamentalism of this cult who were kind of after Alessa because she didn't have a father and she seemed to kind of harbor some kind of supernatural entity, and she was assaulted, and they just went after her because she was an other. And that is what essentially caused the good and bad Alessa to break. And then the goodness became Sharon and the darkness became Alessa. And again, you realized that just as the zombies aren't the evil thing in Resident Evil, it's Umbrella. It's not Alessa who's evil necessarily. It's the cult. It's the insanity and intensity that they operate with that is actually causing the most harm.
Yeah, and it's funny in this film because there is foreshadowing that there's going to be religious elements throughout the beginning of the film. When Sharon is at the precipice of a cliff at the very beginning, there's an illuminated cross in the distance. When they're driving into Silent Hill, they drive by a sign with like a psalm on it or something like that. And yet, in spite of that, I was kind of like, oh yeah, we're getting into cult territory here, because for the most part, you're focused on the monsters and the scary shit that's happening in Silent Hill. Pyramid Head does not look like a religious biblical evil. We learned that Alessa was assaulted by the school janitor, who is grotesquely mutilated, that Rose comes across in the bathroom. So there's numerous things that deflect us from the fact that the ultimate evil at the heart of this city is in fact this cult.
And that Alessa needed Rose and she needed Sharon to kind of fall into this other dimension in order to expose them and in order to entrap them and gain entrance into this church-like sanctuary that they have where they retreat when the darkness comes. And that led me to thinking a bit about fundamentalism, and specifically fundamentalism as it rose in America, which is initially how the kind of whole notion of fundamentalism started. Now, talking about fundamentalism in the 21st century, it has a shit ton of connotations, and it has Islamophobic connotations, xenophobic connotations. There's a lot of worry and panic around it. But getting back to the origins of fundamentalism is it started in the late 19th century and early 20th century with American Protestants. And for them, it was a defense of the fundamentals of their belief systems. So technology was advancing, industrialization was upon them, and gosh, weren't they just getting away from the good times when things were pure and simple and a few people had power rather than more people having education and more opinions and more to contribute, which caused them to have more status within communities and society. So initially it was about getting back to basics for a lot of people, but then it expounds and it deals with fear and power, which are always complicated and messy, messy things. And as I was watching the film this time, I was really struck again. The visuals are so stunning that I think they tend to take away from some of the narrative aspects. And putting together the notions of religious fundamentalism, and I think in Silent Hill, it's very clearly coded as Christian fundamentalism. All the members of the cult are very kind of white bread and kind of old-timely dressed, and the church that they hide in is coded as very Christian. Again, there are crosses, there are psalms peppered throughout the whole environment of Silent Hill. And then you add to that, again, it's such a beautiful visual, but this constant, almost snow-like ash that's falling throughout all of the things that you learn come from the coal fires underground. And I was just like, God, this is like the Make America Great nightmare. This was like what Donald Trump was peddling on the campaign trail. Like, we're going to get back to basics. We're going to make America great again. The coal mines will somehow reopen because Lord knows that was a good career choice. And this is like some 10 years before this like nightmare of it. And it just kind of blew me away. And again, you're dealing with, we've talked about this in episodes before, but, you know, the small town rural versus, you know, the bigger city, certainly more upper class sphere that Chris and Rose occupy. So there's a lot of tension already there. And the sense that when you have Chris dealing with the detective is very much like, no, you leave this at like the boundaries of this town, you don't go any further. So there's a protectiveness, there's a fear of it. It's a very complicated and I think very timely film.
It is very complicated. And I think a lot of the films that we're talking about, a lot of the films that you hinted at earlier about the surprise witch film, a lot of those films have a latent indictment of fundamentalism as you're fanatical, you're wrong, you're burning people, you're projecting your own evils onto someone who's innocent and burning them alive for it. And the burnings in this film, by the way, are hideous. And like, these are people essentially roasted on a spit. This isn't just people on a stake. It's very graphic and very harrowing, especially the demise of Sybil. It's heart-wrenching. But what's interesting about Silent Hill is that that church did keep them safe. They were safe in there from whatever it was Alessa was bringing. So there is an argument to be made that we don't know who Alessa's father was, and she did have these powers, and the church is protecting her. So maybe they were a little right?
Maybe.
They were at least protected by it somehow. And I appreciate that complexity.
Yeah. And again, I think like we've talked about in our witches episode and everything, that good and evil is just all about standpoint. One person's good is another person's evil. And I like that Silent Hill seeks to complicate that through a video game narrative and through a really popularized narrative.
So as I was saying before, Silent Hill, in contrast to Resident Evil, was a film that was very much made to please fans, and something that I was able to glean from my research, particularly my research within YouTube, within people who are passionate about the games. And people are very passionate about these games. Silent Hill came out in 1999. It was after Resident Evil had established what was going to become the survival horror genre. And what was different about Silent Hill was the playable characters were very much normal people. The only common thread throughout all the Silent Hill titles, except one, is that normal people are often searching for someone or discovering their own true origin within the town. And these games often feature an otherworld or another layer of reality where physical law doesn't apply, and manifestations of the characters' thoughts and minds can appear. And particularly in Silent Hill 2, which I've seen heralded as the first very deeply complex and psychological video game, has three strong characters who experience the town of Silent Hill in very different ways. And you can see that Pyramid Head is a strong representation of one person's repressed something. There's actually a really chilling YouTube video that shows Pyramid Head kind of raping these two mannequin body things. It's really fucked. Anyway, in these games, the characters have direct connections to these monsters, such as Pyramid Head or the nurses or the Grey Children. So I strongly feel that Gon's opted to preserve these villains to show them because the fans wanted to see them without giving them a direct tie to Rose and Sybil, which is maybe what makes it a bit confusing for us to read from the outside. Now, it also bears mention that more contemporarily, in 2014, an interactive trailer was released for what everyone believed would be Silent Hills. It was a new PS4 title that would be a collab with Metal Gear creator Hideo Kojima and director Guillermo del Toro, starring actor Norman Reedus. Holy trifecta, like people were losing it, and rightfully so, because the playable trailer that was released, referred to now as PT, was amazing. It was downloaded over a million times across platforms. People played it again and again. And this is just a trailer. Like, this is just a little playable thing to show you what the game is going to be. But it was so good that PT was treated as a really high-performing release in and of itself. Now, to everyone's disappointment, Konami announced the title was canceled in 2015 and PT has been pulled from the PlayStation Store. So if you missed it, like me, too fucking bad. I never got to play it. I got to watch some of it because I was living with a hardcore gamer at the time as a roommate, and he was like, you have to play this. It's amazing. And I was busy and I figured I'd get to it because where's it going to go, right? It's a trailer, but it has disappeared into the ether, and subsequent survival horror games that have come out, everything is getting compared to PT. Resident Evil put out their latest installment just this past year, and it was a very big title. It incorporated PlayStation's virtual reality technology, and everyone is trying to be the spiritual successor to PT, but it just never happened.
Oh my God, I want this game now. Me too. It sounds awesome.
You can watch playthroughs online, and some of them are narrated really obnoxiously, but the fact of the matter is the PT is really fucking scary. So whatever dude bros you have talking tough, I'll piss their pants by the end of the video. So it's all right.
I think this film is also notable for being one of the few films or any kind of fictional narrative where Sean Bean doesn't die. Sean Bean being the actor who plays Chris. My initial understanding was that the Chris character, the husband character, wasn't necessarily a part of the narrative or wasn't nearly as big a part of the narrative as he wound up being. And he's not a huge part. He's just kind of this character who helps evolve parts of the story and, again, keeps one foot in the ground of reality. It's like, you know, when you're really drunk and you always hear that advice like, oh, if you're lying in bed and the room's spinning, you put one foot on the ground and that helps the room stop spinning. I feel like Sean Bean and Chris in that character, he is the one foot on the ground, because otherwise I feel like you really wouldn't have a hold on the film. And I feel like if I was watching this film with just the Rose and Sharon and Sybil narrative, I probably still would like it, but I think I would have more problems with it. I think having Chris and having the detective walking through this thing, having totally different light, having way more naturalistic mise-en-scene helps focus in a weird way the heightened reality of the other dimension that the other characters are in. So me as a viewer, I can say like, okay, I buy how crazy this other narrative is because I know it's happening parallel to another narrative. So it feels much more dreamlike, much more nightmarish. And again, dreams are rooted in our subconscious and tend to be highly illogical. So it plays really well. And again, I think these are very smart little twists and turns that Gone really added and help situate the film, not in a reality, but in a way that makes sense to us as a viewer or even as a game player, because you want to be able to figure stuff out and you want to be able to move through a world having some sense of what direction you're going in. And I think this film does that very well.
Absolutely. I think Chris's storyline also really heightens the pathos and the tragedy of the entire film, particularly in the ending. Obviously, the ending is very tragic to see them come home after all of this and find themselves in a different reality and not to be able to reunite with Chris. But there's also a scene where Rose is in the hallway and she's all alone. She's just been terrorized by Pyramid Head and she breaks down and she crumbles in a hallway and starts crying. And Chris is right there, and he can kind of like feel her, and he kind of gets this gust and he feels like he can smell her, and she's suffering nearby and he can't support her. And I really felt that. I thought that was really lovely.
Rose!
Put your mask on.
Rose! Where are you?
I found her.
You what?
Her perfume.
I also felt a strong sense of gameplay and game logic from this film that I don't actually see in many other movies based on video games, Resident Evil or otherwise. I found that when she is traversing difficult terrains and she's kind of hopping from one thin platform to another, that's very gamey to me. And then when she is in the bottom of the hotel and she finds the drawing that's just stashed into one of the room's mailboxes and, oh, well, we've got to go up into that room. That is video game logic. That's the kind of thing that when it happens in a game, you're like, that's what I have to do. No questions asked. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense in the real world.
Oh, and the nurse sequence as well.
I love that.
It's so well done. And I think in large part it's well done because, I mean, these films don't make a lot of sense, right? But like any horror film, like any film whatsoever, as long as you have an internal logic, that's all you need. I think to impose any other kind of logic on it tends to, you're just having a different conversation with yourself or with someone else. But if you stick to an internal logic, that works. So the fact that the light kind of triggers the nurses, these malevolent, murderous, like fucked up nurses to act is really cool. And they set that up really well in the film. So it makes sense to me as a viewer. And then it makes sense on another level because it's so aesthetically creepy and pleasing. And this film was, I believe, almost entirely shot in Toronto. And interesting side note, I used to work with the guy who was the movement coordinator for all of the monsters, so nurses and everything. Ooh. And he played Pyramid Head and the tied up janitor.
No way.
Yeah. But I think that adds to it, the fact that you have someone who is an incredible dancer and choreographer who can understand movement. And obviously, if you're an artist, you can watch something like a video game, interpret the art from that and say, okay, let's play around with how we get that movement. And then if you're working with a director who is super passionate about it, they can work with timing and editing tricks and filmic techniques to make the movements even more unsettling and weird. And I think that adds to it. And it's that attention and that care that make it, in my opinion, a much more cohesive film than it should be. Like describing this film to someone who's never seen it, I would not know what to make of it. But watching it, it's a very visceral experience. It's creepy. It's weird. It's on occasion very frightening. And as Andrea was saying, there's some really deeply emotional moments of it. Not only do Chris and Rose have a very seemingly loving relationship, even though they're only in one scene together, they deeply care about a child. And that's cool.
Now, we should perhaps mention in passing that there is a terrible sequel. Silent Hill Revelation 3D took place 6 years after the events of the film without Christoph Gans and Roger Avery. It stars Game of Thrones Kit Harington, Malcolm McDowell, Carrie Ann Moss, Sean Bean came back. So there's not potential there. It sounds like there is, but there's not. The film focuses mostly on the video game Silent Hill 3, and we've got Rose, who's able to free Sharon from Silent Hill's ultimate dimension with a talisman called the Seal of Metatron. And that's where my discussion ends. Like, Metatron, really?
I will just say, in this film's defense, I watched it a few years ago, very hungover, and I didn't hate it.
5% approval rating on Rotten Tomatoes. Not that Rotten Tomatoes is the end-all be-all, but I don't think I've ever looked up a film and seen such a low rating.
No, that makes sense because I think I had about 5% brain capacity that day. Parts of the Silent Hill video game and very much the film are based on an actual place called Centralia, Pennsylvania. And that is an abandoned ghost town where coming up, I believe it's on the 4th of July, the firefighters would light the local garbage dump on fire to burn off all the garbage. And then it accidentally got into the coal mines and like started this huge underground fire and just released carbon monoxide and opened up huge sinkholes and people were dying. And like, it was this huge thing and it's still there. Like, there are warnings, like, don't go there, but you can still drive there. And like, people do, and they have all like these creepy abandoned houses. And so it is actually based on a real place. Like, the world we live in can harvest this kind of thing. And there was a real panic around it. I believe it was in the 80s. So it became a bit of a national news story for a little bit. And the government had to reinvest money in bordering out some of the houses, and they couldn't really force anyone to leave. But obviously, a lot of people died. A lot of people got very sick, and most of the townspeople did leave, but it was mainly a mining town. It was a small but very prosperous mining town, which just got fucked up because some firemen didn't know how to put out a fire. Like, that's actually it.
You had one job.
You had one job. But you can read about Centralia and a bunch of websites like Ghost Towns of America. Like, that's actually one of the websites in the movie. And that's, you know, almost to me like a parody of how you would find out about Centralia. But there is actually a really good documentary that I found on YouTube, and it's almost feature length. And it's very in-depth, and they talk to a lot of the people who used to live there. So we'll link that in the episode notes if you are interested and want to do a road trip.
You know, the people in Centralia say, we'd like to stay. There would have been no staying.
They just didn't want to go. They were attached to that community.
The only option they felt at that time, feasible funding option, was to relocate the citizens.
Now, while there are real-life parallels, I think as we wrap up the conversation of Silent Hill, we would do it a disservice to not talk about the theories that surrounded it. And obviously, I have my theory about how it's, you know, Donald Trump's fantasy town and all of that. But you can look at Silent Hill that Sybil and Sharon and Rose all died in the car accident, and they're just kind of stuck in this purgatory. And they all are. I mean, that was my reading of it. And that's where the cult is. They're not, you know, in heaven or hell. They're in this, like, terrifying purgatory, which causes them to go further and further back into themselves, and they retreat without ever actually learning anything.
That's one theory I saw. Another theory I saw was that perhaps Sharon's peek at the devil at the end. Remember when her mom says, don't look, and she has a peek and she sees Dark Alessa. Maybe she let the devil in such that they couldn't escape the other world, or maybe the devil that possessed Rose never left. Those theories are out there. Personally, I don't think they really contribute anything to my understanding and or enjoyment of the film.
But they're there, just like another dimension might be. I just wanted to make one point in wrapping up discussion on both these films, is I found it was very interesting that they both kind of centered around the quote-unquote evil little girl. So you have the Red Queen in Resident Evil. Even though she's a security system, she is personified as a little girl through lasers. And in Silent Hill, of course, you have Alessa. Again, it's just a weird thing to pick on this little girl figure. Again, I think little girls, as we've talked about probably before on this podcast, are seen as our society's sense of purity and goodness and femininity and all of these kind of things, the things that we're supposed to hold near and dear to our hearts. But as I was saying a little bit before, I think these films serve to expose how frail our notions of what good and evil is, and that the elements outside of these little girl figures actually are far more evil than they could ever be. And I think that's what you do is you, in my understanding of video games and how I think of them, is you set off on one mission and you seek to achieve it and you seek to defeat the big bad. And I think if you're going to make a film and even a really good video game, you have to play with your audience's expectations of what the big bad is. It's not totally satisfying to just go up against one monster and beat it. There has to be like another monster behind it. And I think if we have explored anything today, it is that the big monster behind the other big monster is capitalism and or patriarchy.
We knew it all along. So thank you for joining us on this decidedly lighthearted episode. We'd been wanting to do this episode for a long time. I'm so glad we finally got to it, and I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please do drop us a rating on iTunes. It helps us out a lot. We appreciate it. Let us know what you thought. We can be found on Twitter, Facebook, as well as our own website. And I should also mention that my first issue of Rue Morgue magazine as editor is dropping on May 1st. And so to celebrate that, I have a bit of a treat for you guys. I have set up a coupon code for a 20% discount for Faculty of Horror listeners to get a subscription to the magazine. The coupon code is Faculty of Horror, all in caps, and that's good for 20% off of North American subscriptions only. Sorry, international listeners. And that's valid from May 1st to May 31st. So if you were looking for an excuse to hook up with Rue Morgue magazine, this is it. Again, that code is Faculty of Horror for 20% off at rue-morgue.com.
So for our next episode, we're going to do something that I've actually never seen before, and I've been looking for an excuse to see it. So this is great. We will be talking about Takashi Miike's Audition.
Yeah, it's been a while since I've seen it. I've been dying to come back to it. I have a cute anecdote about meeting Takashi Miike last year that I've been looking forward to sharing. And Audition is a big film, and we haven't done international horror in a little while, so we're going to do it. That's going to be our May episode.
Oh, I also have a really cute anecdote about meeting Takashi Miike.
Do you really?
No. So thank you so much for listening. Thank you for all your support. It means so much to us. Keep letting us know what you think. Keep interacting with us. Keep getting levels up and getting more lives and powering up.
Look at you trying to use gamer jargon.
And getting those mushrooms.
You're such a noob.
And those little tulips that spit fireballs at you.
Oh, my God.
So until next time.
Office hours are closed.
This was a triumph. Making a note here, huge success. It's hard to overstate my satisfaction. Aperture Science. We do what we must because we can. For the good of all of us, except the ones who are dead. But there's no sense crying over every mistake. You just keep on trying till you run out of cake. And the science gets done and you make a neat gun for the people who are